the it's attached to the mucus layer, and it's going to be that first signal that's basically going to be working with the pathogens to try to remove those pathogens before they actually cause an immune response. Now there's two different types, and this is going to be important because on some of the lab work, on some of the stool cultures, we're going to actually see that they're going to identify these two different types. And the point of these two different types of secretory IgE are just because the different types target different pathogens. So depending upon if we're looking at the IgAs in the blood or the IgAs on the gut, that is basically going to depend on if it's a higher ratio of the type A1 versus the type A2. And that's just going to be dependent upon what type of pathogens tend to be more found in the blood versus the gut. So we'll have both IgA and IgA1 and IgA2 in both areas. And so if we're seeing, say, normal levels of A1 but not normal levels of A2 or vice versa, that could just mean that whatever type of pathogen they're going to attack could be, our immune system could have a higher propensity of not removing them effectively.
So the pathway of infection. So this is a really great model for looking at how digestive infections set in. And so this is a really important thing for us to trace backwards how things might have gotten in, and or to look at how damage to different areas of the gut can impact in different ways, and how we might sort of estimate that the progression of damage to the gut might likely occur. So this can be helpful for us to look at both assessing how things set in and looking at the different areas that we want to treat.
So now remember, this IgA is removing things before our body even recognizes them. So as really truly a problem, before our inflammatory system recognizes them as a problem. So this first layer of defense, if this first layer of defense is working correctly, things are trapped in the mucus layer that's secreted by the goblet. The secretory IgA basically works to attack them. We have this immune response that happens without an inflammatory response. So really what's happening here, our body should not even have much of a realization that this pathogen is truly here.
So to back up a little big picture on these three areas in the pathway of infection, first is this first defense is the mucus layer, then the epithelial, and then the M cells. So we're going to look at all three. So this is the mucus layer is this first defense, and SIgA being an important piece of that.
So it's a question how the, if that first defense happens and activates the immune system without the inflammatory response, is the pathogen then somewhat like neutralized and killed right there, or it binds to it and then excretes it with the stool? Like how does it get out or stop?
What I've seen in research is that it's binding with it and releasing it through the stool. Doesn't that mean that that other mechanism is not happening as well? Mm-hmm. But what I've seen is that it's binding and releasing it. Have you seen anything else?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I mean, if the immune system were to kill it, you know, there would be some LPS probably, but that, if there weren't leaky gut, might not cause an inflammatory response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what I'm seeing in the research is that first line defense, we're not getting much inflammation from that. So that's one of the big take home things that I've seen in the research. If all is working well, correct. And it's certainly possible that some, you know, portion of things could be cleared by the SIgA, but not everything. And we could run into the second defense here. In the second defense, we're really dealing now with the epithelial layer. So we're dealing with the enterocytes. Remember, the enterocytes have a way of contacting the immune system. So the enterocytes are going to basically release the chemokines, the cytokines, which, remember, are those chemical messenger systems, those chemical messengers for the rest of our leukocytes and lymphocytes. So we have that the second defense system, that the epithelial layer is essentially triggering the lymphocytes, the leukocytes, to go into action. And then this is also, we're going to have those Treg NK cells, the ones with the NK receptors. And those, remember, are the ones that are going to help infected cells die injured cells die, so they can help remove the cells that are infected, the cells that are a problem before the infection, say, spreads. So that's going to be a big part of the second defense layer as well.
And then the third defense are the M cells, which are microfold cells, which we already talked about. And so the purpose here is to phagocytize the antigen, present it to the Peyer's patches and the lymph cells, which have a bunch of T cells and B cells, and that's going to really help trigger that immune response. But can backfire if we get, virus doing a molecular mimicry of an antigen or some other mechanism by which a pathogen might be able to get through that third line of defense. So hopefully a pathogen or issue gets taken care of in that first line of defense from the mucosa through SIG-A activating an immune response, getting it out. Or if that doesn't work, then through the epithelial mechanisms. And finally, if that doesn't work, hopefully the M cells will be able to get rid of that pathogen. So those are sort of those three layers or lines of defense.
So then we have other cells of our small intestinal tract that you should just be aware of. One are the enterochromaffin cells. The enterochromaffin cells will secrete serotonin, and they'll secrete 400 times more melatonin than pineal gland. So it's obviously a ton. Serotonin, as most of us know, doesn't really cross the blood-brain barrier very well. So the serotonin here is mainly, from what we can see in research, mainly the purpose is to activate the migrating motor complex. So serotonin can help. There's serotonin receptors all throughout our gastrointestinal tract to help that migrating motor complex move when we're in the fasting state. Melatonin, however, is very readily able to cross the blood-brain barrier. And so that's really interesting and, something that, we were talking about that we haven't researched but is a curiosity is, like, what happens to people if they have insomnia and we don't do anything other than heal their gut? How much does that actually cure insomnia? Because if this is 400 times more melatonin than the pineal and melatonin crosses the blood-brain barrier, we should at least be considering this as, like, possibly a function that is a problem in somebody with insomnia. So that's pretty interesting.
So at the serotonin secretion, that the serotonin secretion from these cells is not affecting depression. So.
Doesn't seem to be from what research is saying. It seems to be just because there's not a rate of blood-brain barrier crossing. Now, some other research is suggesting that the blood-brain barrier is perhaps a little more permeable than we used to think.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see from a serotonin and GI perspective, like, as research continues, perhaps we'll learn more. But from right now, what the research is saying is that it's not crossing very easily, and it's probably its main purpose is for the migrating motor complex.
So part three, GI tract symptoms and connections to other systems. Really important to be aware of the connections between the GI and other systems, because that's going to point us to looking at the GI. Someone, a client, they're going to come in with a skin issue or a hormonal issue or because they're depressed. And if we aren't able to clearly explain why the GI system is connected to that other system, they're going to think we're a little weird by wanting to look at their stool because they're depressed. But if they understand that there's a real gut-brain connection, and we can talk to them a little bit about the research that supports and proves that, then we can really warrant and help people to understand why changing their diet, why working with doing a stool test or a SIBO breath test are going to be really important factors for recovering from something that seems potentially unrelated.
So just kind of a overall picture here of different areas that are commonly affected with GI symptoms and GI issues. So remember that this is just what we're seeing as the most common, and that oftentimes there's more symptoms that are more systems we need to think of beyond that. But we see immune, endocrine, skin, brain, detoxification, as being the five main systems that are affected by GI disturbances.
So these ones, the research is really clear. There are more than this, but this is, you know, very clear, very important that issues in any of these other systems that we're really addressing the gut and taking that into consideration.
So endocrine system. So the endocrine system, basically one of the biggest things we have to look at here is estrogen and glucuronidation. So the process of basically recycling and getting estrogen broken down and out of our bloodstream, we're going to go through this so much more in the female hormone module, but just as a little overview, there is basically in the liver, we attach a bond to estrogen. It's called the glucuride bond. And that glucuride bond is really important in estrogen's ability to be moved from the liver to the bile, to the small intestine when the bile is, gallbladder is contracted and releases bile out of our intestinal tract into our stool. That's kind of the mechanism of how we get rid of estrogen. Now, what we see is that the gut, when we're having dysbiosis, when we have a dysbiosis state, what we see so clear in the research is that glucuride bond that was basically attached to the estrogen in the liver is broken. Now, when that bond is broken, estrogen can basically reabsorb from the small intestine into the bloodstream, essentially, and it gets recycled. So this is a mechanism with like dysbiosis, how we can get to be in an estrogen dominant state, because as we're trying to get the estrogen out in the stool, it through the gallbladder, through the biliary system, dysbiosis prevents that from happening by breaking that glucuride bond.
So we can definitely see estrogen dominance be one symptom or byproduct of a gastrointestinal infection because of that beta-glucuronidase enzyme and unbinding and reforming that estrogen molecule, letting it go back into circulation. That means that the liver's, you know, one of the liver's mechanisms for getting rid of the hormone through the bile can be impaired. Now, there are some other ways to bind the hormone so that it's not available to the cells and other mechanisms that our body has to regulate hormones. So it's not the only picture, but it definitely is one that we have to seriously consider when we're looking at hormone imbalance.
So, and then GI tract, brain neurotransmitters, we talked about serotonin. There is some thought that serotonin could play a role in basically weight management and satiety and eating behavior. So there could be an addition of its function as far as motility there. Now, dopamine is really interesting because we make 50% of the dopamine in our gut. And there hasn't been as much research that's been conducted to figure out why are we making it there? What function is it actually serving from a gastrointestinal perspective? So that's also pretty interesting.
And when we look at both serotonin and dopamine, we definitely, at least in the brain, see them as regulatory for compulsion and impulsion. So compulsive eating or impulsive eating, compulsive be the consistent worrying about the, you know, sort of ruminating over something. Oh, I want this, I shouldn't eat it, I want it, I shouldn't eat it, whatever that is. Finally giving in, or the impulsive finding yourself with the fridge door open, pulling out something, being like, whoa, what am I doing? So those definitely have an impact from serotonin and dopamine. And we also know that there's a GABA connection, which we'll explore in the mice study. So that essentially there's a very fascinating study where a neurologist who's now researching microbes in the gut because of this gut-brain connection, did a study, and this study took mice, two groups. One group got a sterile bone broth, or not a bone broth, but a broth, but no bacteria, totally sterile. And the other group of mice got Lactobacillus rhamnosus, a probiotic, in their feed. And the first group they took, and they subjected both groups to a mild water stress test. What this means is mice don't like water. So they take a big bowl, they put the mice in the water where they can't get out. And so this is a stressful situation. The mice try to get out, try to get out, try to get out. The first group, the group with the sterile broth feed, tries to get out, swimming around, climbing up, trying to get out for 1 minute, swimming around, trying to get out for 2 minutes, swimming around, trying to get out for 3 minutes. Finally, at the 4 minute mark, they kind of give up and they just resign to their wet circumstances and float there and aren't really trying anymore to get out of there. The other group of mice does that same stress test, goes that same 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes swimming around. They actually continue for, at that 4 minute mark, they continue to try to get up. For a 5th minute, continue to try to get up. At 6 minutes, the researchers pull them because they're clearly significantly more able to have a response of trying to get out of that unpleasant situation. And so they did a couple of things to help to understand why this is happening, what really is happening in their brain and hormones and chemistry. So they measured corticosterone and GABA. And what they found is that in the broth group, that corticosterone was very, very high. Essentially, they got stressed, big cortisol release, and they burned themselves out. What they found in the group that got the probiotic is that they also had a corticosterone release to stimulate them to have the energy to try to get out, but then they had a big GABA release. So GABA, of course, is that inhibitory neurotransmitter that calms things down. So it's sort of like they were, you know, they got this big rush of stress hormone, this corticosterone rush, where they're like, ah, I got to get out, got to try and escape. And then they got this nice GABA response of calming, regulating, coming back to center. Corticosterone response, got to get out, calming response. They were regulating their stress response on the fly. And it was the gut communicating with the brain that was regulating this. In order to prove that, they took this group that had done better, 6 minute stress response, got the probiotic feed, they cut their vagal nerve, immediately reverted back to the old stress response, 4 minutes gave up. It really was the communication from the gut through the vagal nerve to the brain that stimulated that GABA response in the brain. So in addition to looking at the hormones that might be generated by the gut itself, like serotonin and dopamine, we also need to look at the communication via the vagal nerve between the gut, stimulating the brain to produce endogenous neurotransmitters like GABA. So we do see a definite relationship to that, and we see that that gut microbiome, that microbial ecology in the large intestine, may very well impact our personality at a deep level, may very well impact how we respond to stress, how resilient we are in the face of difficulty, how much we're willing to try and keep going and learn from and grow stronger from stressful situations versus burning ourselves out, resigning to our circumstances, and just eating the ice cream because we can't bear to actually do something different with our life so we can take in that sweetness that just says, oh, it's okay. I'll just be with this and comfort myself with sweets. Which is sort of, you know, definitely part of the mind root cause behind an addictive relationship to sweets is, especially in Chinese medicine, we see that sweets, that sweet flavor is this sense of it's okay. And we use that for children. They get stressed, it's okay. Here's some ice cream, here's some candy, here's some something to just, you know, accept circumstances, which can be good up until a point, when sometimes we can take it to excess and resign to circumstances instead of taking a stand, following our heart, having courage to take action and move ourselves into a new phase or place in life.
So other areas of relationship with the GI tract and other systems is detoxification. So more and more and more we're hearing about phase three, the detoxification. Now, what is a little bit harder to grasp is that phase three in a lot of ways is actually the first phase, part of phase three. Because phase three begins in the gastrointestinal tract with cytochrome 3A4, which kind of lines that epithelial border. So Cytochrome 3A4 in a lot of ways is the first place that we ingest orally anything that is a toxin. This is actually the first detoxification that's going to happen. It's actually in our intestinal tract. So cytochrome 3A4 will begin to break it down. Then the toxin will move through the portal vein from the small intestine to the liver. And at that point, we'll actually have phase 1, phase 2 of detoxification occur. Or toxins that make their way through the bloodstream can make their way to the liver for phase 1 and phase 2. But the beginnings of it from an orally ingested toxin is with the cytochrome 3A4 in the intestinal tract.
Is that happening in one of in the epithelial cells?
I forget what cell particularly, but I believe it's epithelial cells is where we're getting that from. We'll have to verify that though.
I think we talked about it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's where it is.
So GI tract and the immune system, we mentioned that a lot of the immune system resides in the GI tract. So 70 to 80% of our immune cells are in the digestive tract. So that's a huge amount. Clearly, this boundary between who we are and what we let go of with respect to the food that we take in is a big part of immunity. Now, when we look at immunity from a mind-body perspective, we can see that the immune system is our capacity to differentiate self from not self, and our capacity to be able to also have a sense of an adaptability or a flexibility with respect to change. When do we see people get sick? Frequently.
Stressed.
When they're stressed. And when do people get stressed?
Well, when they get sick, that's part of it, I suppose.
Yeah, when they get sick, or?
When their gut's not healthy.
When their gut's not healthy, or what about?
Busy.
What about, busy, or what about change? Big change.
Yeah.
I mean, is big change stressful? Is one of the big stressors for people? I mean, when we look at these big stressors, the ones that really impact the HPA axis, those chronic stresses that can, permanently reset that HPA mechanism for the glucocorticoid receptors, for example, on the hypothalamus or the pituitary, getting either resistance or excessive sensitivity. We see that often these are big changes. Lost the job, broke up with the partner of 20 years, had a divorce, someone died. I mean, these are the things that these are huge changes, big shifts, big adjustments. When we think of the immune system and we talk about it in Chinese medicine, we really talk about this Wei Qi layer, which has to do with protecting from what's called wind invasion. Wind, the Chinese character for wind, I mean, this is thousands of years ago, you have to remember. This character is actually comprised of two other characters, the character for insect and then the character for air. And so there's this idea that there's little insects or pathogens potentially that can invade or infect. Now, this is their language thousands of years ago before microscopes and before germ theory and anything like that. They had this understanding that our bodies can become invaded and that we have this system, they called it the Wei Qi layer, that's capable of pushing it out or protecting us, fighting off that infection. And so when we think about wind and we look in our language, we see winds of change is an expression that people will use. Oh, the winds of change. Things are changing, shifting around. So when we think about immunity, we have to think about change and adaptability to change. And when the seasons change, when we hit winter time and there's the change in season, that's a big time when people get sick. Of course, when people are stressed by a big life change, people are getting sick frequently. So when we think of immunity, we have to think about our capacity for change and our capacity to differentiate what's me and what's not me, what's appropriate to take in and what do we need to let go of. So we see this in the gut being one of the key places where we differentiate me from not me. We know that from the brush border of the intestines. And we know that that can get confused and we can have leaky gut and let in undigested protein molecules and or pathogens can get in through the M cells. So those are ways that we might get confused, and that that immune system, that capacity to adapt to change, because pathogens are adapting to change too, right? They have these virulence factors. How can we, our immune system, adapt quicker to those changes? So our capacity mentally, emotionally to adapt to change in our life will impact our immune system, and we see that the gut is a big area of focus for this immunity.
This is another place we need to consider. It's a common thing that I think probably all of us see is people coming in and they're chronically getting sick. They're chronically getting sick. And certainly, like, stress is one thing that most of us turn to, like, how are you managing stress, like we're talking about. But really, anytime we're dealing with any sort of immune dysregulation, whether it's chronic frequent colds, chronic frequent flus, whether it's Lyme disease, different viruses, Epstein-Barr, for example, anytime we're dealing with an immune dysregulation, whether or not we have symptoms in the gut, we always need to consider this. And this is something we need to consider with all of these different systems, is that 50% of people with gastrointestinal infections have zero gastrointestinal symptoms. 50%. So, you know, thinking that we're just going to be triggered to look in the gut just because somebody is having constipation or bloating or diarrhea isn't really realistic from a clinical perspective. So that's why we're talking about some of these other systems, is because anytime we're having a detoxification issue, anytime we're having a hormonal issue, a skin issue, an immune system issue, we always want to ask, should we look into the gut? And let's not judge that question upon their symptoms. So, and certainly immune dysregulation is in that category. If we have somebody that is not getting well chronically, we always want to say, well, 70 to 80% of our immunity is in our gut. So let's look and see what is happening there.
GI tract in the skin, there's a big relationship there. The naturopathic and Chinese medical traditions have recognized this for thousands of years. They've seen that these gut issues can manifest through the skin. And we definitely are seeing that now in research. We have research about H. pylori and higher incidence of rosacea. So that's one example. We have research about Entamoeba histolytica, a parasite, and pruritus. So we are seeing some of these connections pop up in the research. And bless you. We also see a higher incidence of eczema, acne, other skin issues, and nail issues with low hydrochloric acid, low stomach acid. So that's another thing that we're seeing, a relationship between some of the digestive system and the skin. So there's going to be a bunch more research that's going to come in particular about the microbial populations and specific bacteria residing in the large intestine and their relationship to skin. I think we have a long way to go before we really understand that completely and deeply, but it's beginning and we're going to see more and more of that too.
So signs of GI involvement. So of course we have our obvious signs. So anytime we're going to see the obvious GI signs of constipation, bloating, abdominal pain, weight changes, heartburn, any of these different signs we see here, we're going to obviously think about what's going on in the gastrointestinal tract, what labs should I run, what questions around emotional health and mental stability should I be asking.
And sometimes people have habituated to some of these symptoms. Someone could have a lot of bloating, but they don't know what it feels like to be non-bloated. So they might not really say that they're bloated, but they may be bloated. So we really have to differentiate and discern, and we have to ask good questions, but we also have to realize that, you know, just like with stress, where someone could be really stressed out chronically, but, you know, they're like, I'm not stressed, this is normal for me. But you know, you can clearly tell that they're shallow breathing really fast and they're lost in the story of their thoughts and worry and concern. And it's clear from an outsider's view that they're stressed out, but from inside they may not feel that way. Well, same can happen for some of these digestive symptoms too. So we have a really good chart for constipation, diarrhea we'll go over that's helpful for that in case people are habituated to that. And there are some good questions to ask to further, bloating, because, or gas, because people might think, oh, well, everyone has gas, which, you know, yeah, everyone has gas from time to time, but what's a normal amount? That's going to be a different definition for different people.
The other thing I want to say about the bloating that you're reminding me of that comes up tons clinically is that people don't always seem to associate, I've learned that, bloating with intestinal bloating. That oftentimes I'm finding that people associate bloating with what we would clinically call edema. So a lot of times I'll question somebody about bloating, and then when I'm like further questioning, I'm finding that they mean their rings don't fit or that their ankles swell. So, which, you know, we would typically call more like an edema type of situation. So with bloating, it's another thing to really make sure we're being clear about so we understand what's happening, is that, you know, we're talking about an expansion of the stomach where we eat a meal and all of a sudden we feel like we have to unloosen our pants. Or we eat a meal and we realize that bending over to tie our shoe is pretty uncomfortable and painful. So those types of questions are going to really help differentiate that it's actually intestinal bloating and it's not just swelling and edema somewhere or other.
Or do people just feel tight here most or all of the time? You know,
mm-hmm.
If it feels like there's some pressure there, it might take a little bit of questioning for someone to differentiate that's what we mean by bloating or distension. You know, I don't bloat after a meal, but how about, do you feel pressure there all the time, tension there all the time? Oh yeah, it's not very comfortable. You know?
Yeah, as somebody who's had so many digestive problems, I didn't even really, even with all the medical training I've had, I didn't realize that I was experiencing bloating until I got myself to a point where I wasn't bloated. And then I was like, holy cow, that was bloating. But even with all this training, it was just so normal to me because I was in the category of like, it wasn't just food, I was just always bloated. So, you know, there's definitely that normalization that happens to all of us.
So symptoms of low HCL, nail issues, just asking about symptoms of HCL. So the nail issues and skin issues.
Will you actually say the whole question?
So with HCL, what are some of the symptoms of low HCL from the skin perspective that we covered? So there, you know, with HCL, we have to look at digestive symptoms. We'll go over this in more detail later, but we have to look at digestive symptoms like protein digestion or getting full easily. We also have to look at skin and nails. So we have to look at things like acne, eczema, brittle nails, and then we also have to look at malabsorption issues. So signs of low iron, even if they're eating red meat, or things that might be signs of low minerals of other kinds, or general weakness, or signs of zinc deficiency, things like that are going to be all potential pointers towards hydrochloric acid being low. So
and
we'll cover that in a little,
in
a little more detail when we get there.
So then some non-obvious symptoms. So some of these we covered already. So just skin conditions, autoimmunity, because we could have this immune dysregulation. And the immune dysregulation, we're going to go more into this, but it's more, it's going to be beyond the idea of, say, the fact that so much of our immunity lives in our gut. So much immunity lives in our gut. If that immune system's not working very well, that could lead to chronic infections. But what we'll learn is we're going to talk about a concept that Miles already mentioned called molecular mimicry, which just means that the protein structure of the antigen, of the pathogen, is so similar to the protein structure of our own body that when we actually start attacking that pathogen, we start attacking ourselves because they almost look the same. So that's called molecular mimicry, and that can really contribute to a lot of the autoimmunity. Certainly, depression and anxiety have been hugely correlated to the gut. You know, some of this could definitely be through mechanisms like Miles' story about the mice and about the effect of GABA and the relationship of GABA. So certainly, if GABA is not being secreted correctly, you know, we can have scenarios such as anxiety.
And then fatigue, of course, is a symptom that a lot of people experience. And Chinese medicine from the very beginning has been clear that spleen qi deficiency, which relates, in Chinese medicine, the spleen is more like the spleen pancreas and the digestive system as a whole and that digestive process as a whole. Spleen qi deficiency, fatigue is one of the number one symptoms. So sluggish digestion and fatigue go together really naturally and easily in Chinese medicine, but in Western medicine, it's a little more of a stretch. So we have to think, well, why would someone be fatigued when there's a digestive issue? So we, of course, know in Western medicine that fatigue can relate to thyroid issues, and thyroid can slow down the transit time and the metabolism when it gets low. So if we see constipation and fatigue, we might think there's a relationship with the thyroid, but part of that T4, T3 conversion, T4 being the inactive thyroid hormone, T3 being the active thyroid hormone, happens in the gut. And so gut infections can disrupt that T4, T3 conversion. And, you know, especially if there's also malabsorption, we're not getting enough selenium, which further helps with that T4, T3 conversion. We might not have enough available thyroid hormone that's active for the body, which might further slow down that digestive tract, which might lead to worsened constipation and fatigue. So we can see a relationship there. We can also see fatigue related with hormonal imbalance. And we know that that chronic stress and that mechanism of the glucuronide bond are both mechanisms by which we see a relationship between GI and hormones. So if the hormones are out of whack, that can contribute to fatigue and can be related to the gut.
So, and then adrenal issues, and, you know, we always have to look at with the adrenals, one concept that's been presented to us that I really like is the idea of firemen and fire. And so there's some idea that say, well, the adrenals are going to show up, and the adrenal hormones are basically going to show up with anything stressful. So we have a detoxification issue, we have a pathogen issue, anything that's a stress on the body, we can get a cortisol release. And there's some idea of like, well, if the pathogen is the fire, then the adrenals show up. The adrenals are kind of like the firemen at the fire. So in that scenario, we don't want to make the assumption that every time we see fires, just because the firemen there, that the firemen are the cause, right? So we have the pathogen and the adrenals are the firemen, they show up. Doesn't mean that the adrenal dysregulation, that cortisol caused that pathogen to be there necessarily. You know, because we can also take the flip and realize, well, holy cow, I have stress imbalance, I have cortisol dysregulation. Well, we know cortisol dysregulation is going to cause a decrease in secretory IgA. That's very clear in research. And we get a decrease in secretory IgA, that alone could cause the pathogen. So from that aspect, the adrenals, the cortisol actually could be the fire. So adrenals with so many areas of our health, we're going to see can actually be either the cause, and we see this stress mechanism, or the sequelae that's like showing up to basically try to help fix what has happened. So we always have to remember, it's not always that they're the root, sometimes that they're the root, but the adrenals are so many times involved in these different systems within our health.
And we'll speak in more detail about those mechanisms and how to work with them in the lecture that's focused on adrenals.
And then, so myalgia, so muscle pain. So a lot of muscle pain, a lot of, say, fibromyalgia, one theory on what's happening here is it's all these inflammatory molecules that are basically causing us. And we've talked already about many different ways, and we'll talk through more about how gastrointestinal issues are causing inflammatory molecules. We're having an increase in tumor necrosis factor alpha, increase in lymphocytes and leukocytes and cytokines and chemokines, all these different immune and inflammatory molecules, and that can contribute to the fibromyalgia and other type of myalgias.
And an interesting insight into fibromyalgia that's a recent theory that's coming up is that it may be related to potentially one of the underlying mechanisms being a small fiber type of neuropathy that's happening. And interestingly, one of the treatments that's working for it is alpha-lipoic acid, which has mechanisms for working with neuropathy. It also has mechanisms for working with blood sugar control. And so it's interesting that that's a treatment, and I know that there's a correlation, but I don't know the mechanism of causation behind why ALA, but I'm, you know, curious about learning more about that link with the gut and with blood sugar and fibromyalgia, because that may be more of a player, I think, than we previously realized. So it'll be interesting to see that come up more. And again, Chinese medicine, spleen governs the muscles. So we see muscle issues relating to spleen, qi, and digestion. And of course, we know protein absorption and amino acids are necessary for building muscles. And if we have malabsorption, then we may have issues with muscle development. So we see that link as well.
So other scenarios we see as far as symptomatology would be migraines and headaches, also through inflammatory mechanisms. There's definitely relationships of toxins such as LPS affecting migraines. We also know that any time that we say have a blockage in things like the MRP2 in the gallbladder, like I was talking about, the MRP2 protein, that anytime we have a blockage of that, we're not getting toxins out in the same sort of way. And that backup of toxins can lead to chemical sensitivities, can lead to the headaches, the migraines. Another interesting thing is we know that serotonin and dopamine do play a relationship in the constriction or the relaxation of our vasculature. And we do know that vasoconstriction and vasorelaxation are such key parts of migraines and headaches. And the effect of our vasculature, you know, we don't have to have those hormones crossing the blood-brain barrier in order to have those effects. So that is another mechanism of serotonin and dopamine that are made in our gut that could be contributing to the vessel constriction and the migraines and headaches.
And we also know that certain nutrients are really important, like folate and the capacity to methylate folate with migraines. So if someone has an MTHFR mutation and or they're not getting enough folate in their diet, that may be have a relationship to the development of migraines and headaches. And then we have to think common sense things too, of course, with headaches. You know, what's a common sense thing that we really need to think about and ask about right away? What's that?
Gluten.
Yeah. Gluten's one. And what's another? Who here has ever gotten a headache if you don't drink enough water?
Oh, yeah.
Dehydration. I mean, that's huge. So many people are dehydrated, and many headaches are a result from dehydration. That's a very simple solution, but, you know, when I talk to clients about how much water they're drinking, almost no one's doing what, you know, I usually take a general rule of thumb and take body weight in pounds, divide by two, drink that many ounces a day. Very, very few people are actually drinking that much water. I mean, I had one person in 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about water in relationship to some kidney markers that came up on a lab test, and I was asking her how much she drinks, and she's like, oh, I don't drink much water. And it's like, well, how much? And she's like, well, maybe a 12-ounce bottle. It's like, for the whole day? She was like, yeah, sometimes I have trouble getting through it. It's like, okay, you know, we gotta... How about an 8-ounce glass first thing in the morning before anything else? You know, before you eat, before you do anything. She's like, you know, daunted by that task, even though 16 ounces would be much better. But, you know, some people just aren't drinking near enough water, and that's going to be an obvious thing to rule out. Remember, back to the basics. Hit those things over and over. Make sure those aren't the cause before going into something deeper.
So then common gastrointestinal dysfunction. So really looking at some of the, say, categories of what can go wrong in the GI system. So the first we'll look at is hiatal hernia. And one thing to differentiate between, especially as holistic care providers, is the difference between a hiatal hernia syndrome and a hiatal hernia disease. Now, hiatal hernia disease is when we're going to get the stomach that kind of is fully going to protrude through that diaphragm, and we're actually going to get the stomach displaced. Now, the problem with that is that for that protrusion, what that is really affecting is the lower esophageal sphincter, which is supposed to stay closed to keep the stomach acid in the stomach and not the esophagus. So that's the disease. The disease is the full protrusion. The syndrome is basically when we are having the stomach actually put pressure on that lower esophageal sphincter, on the diaphragm, but not actually fully protrude as when the disease occurs. Now, both of them, both the syndrome and the disease, can cause that sphincter to remain in more of an open position, where stomach acid can actually creep up into the esophagus. So this is one area where somebody can have gastroesophageal reflux and not actually have too much stomach acid. It's just that that stomach acid is creeping back up because of a hiatal hernia. So there is a release technique that we can do in office, which is really just kind of going in and grabbing the stomach. And you just kind of grab the stomach strongly and you hold until you feel it move. And you kind of slide your hands along the left rib margin where the stomach follows, just allowing the body, the hands, to move at the rate the stomach is actually moving when you contact it. And once you kind of follow it all the way around to the point that it's stopping, you'll do these three twists. And those three twists are basically going to help hold the stomach in place a little better. The follow-up homework for this is basically the bouncing.
This is best to do when someone's laying down so that they're relaxed and their muscles aren't tense. And it can even help a little bit to have them bring their knees up so that their feet are on the table or the ground and their back is on the table and the ground. Knees are up. That can even release a little more in here, so it's very, very relaxed. And then you have them take an inhale, you put the hands on. As they exhale, you go in and contact the stomach and then pull down. And you can teach their partner to do this. You can teach people to do a version of it for themselves. It's not going to be near as strong as if we're doing it for them in the clinical setting and they're laying down and they're relaxed. But you can give them a version, and especially if they push in here, and I feel on me like right now it's a little tender, so I could actually use this.
Here,
right,
so
now.
Why don't I just do it on you? So hold this. And so what we'll do is I'm going to kind of find about where Miles' xiphoid is, so right kind of at the bottom of the sternum there. And I don't want to push on the xiphoid ever because the xiphoid breaks with very, very little pressure. So I always want to make sure that I'm below the xiphoid. And once I'm below the xiphoid, I'm going to go contact in. Now, this is going to not be as clear or not be as, say, easy to do since he's not lying down. But imagine that he's lying down. I'll basically go in, and I have my hands, so they're stacked like this. I'm basically putting a certain amount of pressure, and I'm almost like grabbing the top part of the stomach. So I can actually feel through the tissue layer his stomach.
And I can actually feel it radiating back now, so I do need this.
So take a breath in and out. So I'm going to go in, and I'm just going to contact and hold and wait. And as I wait, then I'm going to start following along his left rib margins. And I want to remain in contact with that top part of his stomach. And as I do this, I'm just going to continue to follow around at the rate that his stomach is moving. And it's a little bit hard to feel standing, but it's pretty easy to feel the stomach move.
Yeah, that might be a little slower or a little faster than you'd actually do.
And it really just depends upon the person's speed. So we just kind of continue to follow around to the left. And I would continue until I felt the stomach stop moving. And at that point, I'm going to do three twists that are kind of still going in the direction that my hands were originally going. So it's going to be one. So I'm kind of going down and back over to the right towards his belly button. And I do that three times. And so that's called the hiatal hernia release technique.
And then if you're doing it for yourself or you're teaching someone else to do it for themselves, they can kind of crouch a little bit, relax the back a little bit so they can get in a little more. And then they can breathe in and then out. And then it's a little harder to go fully this way, but it just in a general down direction. Like that. In and down. In and down. In and down. That might be, you know, a little bit helpful at least to break up a little of that scar tissue between the stomach where it might be pushing up against the esophagus and the diaphragm. So that can be a helpful sort of exercise to give someone. And it's great to give people exercises they feel empowered to do something for themselves. And then if they have a partner, you could teach them the more solid one where they're laying down to do a stronger dose for that.
And then, so the follow-up supportive care exercise that we'll give people is basically heel drops and bouncing. And so with this, classically what we would do is we would have somebody get up in the morning and drink 8 to 10 ounces of water. So the water is going to act as a weight in their stomach. Because remember, their stomach is too high in the situation. The stomach's gone up. So we have them drink water. The water acts as a weight. And then we just come and have them up on their toes and bounce down on their heels, which basically is using gravity. So we have weight and then gravity to pull it down. Now there's another layer that we like to add, basically that's kind of a Qigong type of layer, which is basically kind of like... You want to do it?
Yeah, so for this, usually what I'll do is I'll have people first keep feet flat and start bouncing for a while like this. Just get used to it. And so bouncing gently like this, breathing deeply. So, you know, this is already in general helping that body to calm, helping us get some of our excess energy in the head and thought that we have, bringing it down into the body. So already this is going to be just generally relaxing, settling, grounding for people. So doing this for a while. And then maybe after a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, then adding the heels and swinging the arms naturally back and forth and emphasizing that contact with the ground. And then that's going to really help get that stomach down even more. And then the hands can gradually come to a stop.
It's really for that, for the hiatal hernia, it's really like Miles said, that down that you want to emphasize here, because that's that gravity force that we're using.
But we find that maybe it's a little less jarring if first people are doing this. And this is a really nice thing for other reasons. It's just helpful for getting too much excess in our heads down into our bodies and helping people to be more grounded and
helps the lymphatic system too.
Yeah.
So we're getting some
bouncing movements. So that's all really helpful. Sort of, you know, we it's great to have stuff while people are in the office and before we're, you know, gonna run labs and give supplements and stuff, like give people something that they can take home right away and get started with their treatment. People love that, and that's gonna be really helpful. So hypochlorhydria, low stomach acid. So again, those three things that we were talking about before, we'll repeat them and talk in a little more detail. So digestion of protein is a really important piece. And if people are getting excessively full after meals, especially if it was a protein-heavy meal, and even more so classically if we see someone saying something like, oh, it just feels like that meal's sitting in my stomach like a rock. You know, so that's sort of a feeling of something, especially a high-protein meal, sitting in the stomach like a rock. That's classic sign of hypochlorhydria. But it could be just full after meals. It could be they're not hungry or they don't have an appetite in the mornings. That can be a sign of low stomach acid. It could be that they just notice when they have a heavier protein meal that they're not digesting it as well.
Now remember, too, we already talked about another thing that could cause, say, a fullness issue after eating, which was a vagal nerve dysregulation, because vagal nerve is basically what's going to stimulate that migrating motor complex to clean out all the garbage that hasn't been cleaned out. So if somebody is having a parasympathetic issue where they're in sympathetic dominance, that could also lead to this, but that could also lead to a decrease in HDL as well. So remember, there could be a parasympathetic insufficiency at play here too.
So other symptoms we can see are skin, hair, and nails. So there are a variety of things that can cause issues with skin, hair, and nails. So we need to think about the liver also with skin, hair, and nails, but the digestive system is another thing. So when we're thinking about skin and the digestive system, we already talked about H. pylori can contribute. We already talked about Entamoeba histolytica can contribute to skin issues. And we believe that dysbiosis or certain bacterial imbalances can contribute to skin issues as well. So, of course, food allergies and sensitivities. If there's excess histamine release from a food allergy, skin rashes are one common thing. So for me, I have an IgE reaction to salmon. Even if I touch salmon, I'll get hives or rash. But if I eat it, I'll definitely get hives and rash. So that's an example of a histamine IgE type food allergy contributing to skin issues. But low stomach acid can also contribute to skin issues. And we might see a thick white coating on the tongue. That could be a sign that the fluids in the stomach are out of balance. We look at the tongue a lot in Chinese medicine for diagnostic purposes. So that's something we can look for in relation to that. And if we see excessively dry skin or skin that seems like there's mineral imbalance and not enough minerals, then we might think about hydrochloric acid deficiency as well.
Do you see constipation related to low HCL?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Definitely constipation is something to think about. Frequent nausea is something to think about. GERD symptoms, acid reflux, heartburn. These are things to think about with hydrochloric acid deficiency.
But if you take too much for too long, then you get this, you can burn the stomach.
Yeah, so we'll go, the question is, if you take too much stomach acid for too long, the stomach can, you can get a burning or a warm sensation. Yeah, we'll cover that when we go into treatment as to how to deal with supplementation. But yeah, absolutely, you want to definitely monitor supplementation. And it's contraindicated if there's an ulcer. So you want to be careful if there is an ulcer with hydrochloric acid supplementation.
Remember, it's bicarbonate that's going to line the stomach intestinal, the stomach intestinal lining. And that bicarb is what's going to basically help neutralize that acid right at the cell border. So that acid's really kind of in that space within the stomach to basically help with the digestion of food. But the bicarb lines the outside, and it's the bicarb that's going to neutralize the acid so it doesn't affect the cells. So like anything, you know, it's always about not being in excess or not being in deficient situation. So, you know, my thought with what's probably happening there is there's so much acid at a certain point, more than one can actually produce that bicarb layer to basically protect the cells.
And once in a while, we'll get a severe reaction with someone from just one hydrochloric acid pill. And you know, it used to be that I thought, and I think it's a common assumption that means that they're not hydrochloric acid deficient, maybe they're excess. But what we've discovered over the years is that actually it could be that they might still be stomach acid deficient, but the lining is destroyed, so that lining isn't working as well, so it feels intense and painful. So sometimes we need to focus first on rebuilding the stomach lining, and in those cases, we might need to give like branched-chain amino acids to be able to build back that lining and some mucolaginous DGL or things like aloe to help with that lining as well, and build that back before a person could tolerate stomach acid. So that's another situation to be aware of. But frequently, sour regurgitation or heartburn or acid reflux symptoms frequently have a relationship in most cases, in the majority of cases, to low stomach acid, which is counterintuitive at first for people, although natural medicine's done a good job of getting that message out there, so people are starting to wake up to that. But then we also have to consider H. pylori being involved, which is going to lower stomach acid as well. So we see this whole relationship between stomach acid and H. pylori infection. And then if someone's been taking PPIs, even after they get off, we're going to have to probably do a protocol to rebuild their stomach acid.
Then common symptoms with pancreatic enzyme deficiency, bloating, gas, diarrhea. A common thing that I feel like people will come into office and say, both with HCL and pancreatic enzymes and bile, not as much for bile, but certainly in there, is that they've tried these things and they don't work. And I think that's probably since people have access to these things and they know about them commonly, a lot of times this comes up. The thing to always remember with this is just because they said that these things don't work, does not mean that they're not involved as a part of the problem. All it is telling us is that it is not the whole part of the problem. So just because they don't work does not, we shouldn't rule out as like, this is going to be necessary and important at some point, but that it's likely only a piece and not the whole problem. And it's very, you know, it's very clinically rare that we find that this would ever fix an entire problem, just that it's a portion of it.
And I want to backtrack just a little bit to this malabsorption and mineral deficiencies, which I just want to say that clinically I see when there's low iron. Like, so if we do a blood ferritin level and we're looking at the stored iron and that's low, which functionally we'd like to see it in the 50 to 150 range for women, or 50 to 200 for men, that ferritin, if it's less than 50, which is not uncommon at all. You know, I've seen, I saw 9 the other day, 13 not too long ago, many things in the 20s or 30s. And so it's not uncommon at all for stored iron levels to be low. Sometimes they're high too, and that can be a real problem. But if they're low, and I talk to a person and they're not doing a vegan or a vegetarian diet, they're eating plenty of red meat and things like that, I'm thinking strongly about hypochlorhydria. Because why aren't they absorbing their iron? And mineral malabsorption is definitely a big piece. And that might be part of the skin connection too, because we know zinc is such an important part of skin health. And one of the prescriptions for eczema and things like that is to give extra zinc. And so we might think that, well, if there's hypochlorhydria, there might be a malabsorption of zinc that might contribute to skin issues.
Well, we also see that that hypochlorhydria and zinc deficiencies go together. There's some thought that zinc is actually part of what's triggering and what's needed to make the actual stomach acid molecule. They're definitely in the research, hypochlorhydria and zinc very, very well. So certainly I think there can be like a chicken and the egg type of scenario there. And the only thing I would piggyback on what you're saying is another thing with iron in this ferritin situation that we always need to consider is that pathogens use iron. So bacteria, parasites, these sort of things typically use iron as part of their fuel in a lot of ways. And a lot of what they're doing is the iron is the coenzyme for the pathogens, superoxide dismutase. And the superoxide dismutase is basically another mechanism where if our immune system tries to fight the pathogen by an oxidative type of reaction, which is common, the pathogen's iron-dependent superoxide dismutase would basically stop our attack. And so what we find is that iron is necessary for pathogen survival. And so they'll use our stores of iron to survive, and it's a virulence factor how it evades our immune system. So it's something to also consider in addition to hypochlorhydria. If we're seeing low iron, is it because that all these pathogens are basically using all of our iron, which is why it's thought to be contraindicated to supplement iron when there's any sort of dysbiosis or infection going on.
But if there's anemia, that trumps, because anemia, I mean, if we're not getting enough oxygen and we're not getting enough iron to make energy in our body, and someone's dealing with severe fatigue, you know, that usually trumps the issue, and we need to address it and get more iron into the body. But too high of iron, definitely big problem, can be highly toxic, and we absolutely want to pay especially close attention to that when someone has likely or confirmed chronic infections. Biliary dysfunction, so we've talked about floating stool being a sign of potentially an issue with fat absorption and or bile. So bile, of course, is made in the liver, then it is stored in the gallbladder, and then it dumps into the small intestine, mixes with food, helps to emulsify the fats so that when the stool becomes formed, that the stool sinks to the bottom and we don't see an oil at the top. So if we see oil at the top, if we see a floating stool, if we see in severe cases, a gray stool, those are real big signs of biliary dysfunction. And so we definitely want to look at, and so many people have their gallbladder, gallbladder being removed is a common issue. So we really do want to help people keep their gallbladder if at all possible. And if they're starting to show signs, hopefully we catch it before gray stool. That might be too late. to save the gallbladder. But if we catch it before with floating stool or oil on top or things like that, or pain in the right side where the gallbladder is located, especially if it radiates to the shoulder blade, that's a really good sign of gallbladder issues. If your license allows palpating, the liver is always good to see if it's inflamed and see if there's tenderness in the liver gallbladder area. And
what about someone who's had their gallbladder removed, having pain, not radiating into the right shoulder, radiating a little bit to the side here? She's pretty overweight, so it's kind of a large area. It's like, it was hard for me to kind of see where she was talking about. But happening sporadically, and how she'll describe it, with healthy food. So I think probably some healthy fats and maybe even some fiber. So I was wondering if it's a biliary obstruction, no gallbladder, or maybe even a SIBO, getting that fermentation. But definitely right side. What are your thoughts?
So I mean, right side, I mean, you're certainly right to think, you know, gallbladder, she has one, or which obviously she doesn't, yeah. But if she did,
she would still have those ducts,
right? Still have the ducts, right?
So the
question basically is, with pain that's on the right side that's slightly radiating around to the back side, basically, what is it? What would you be thinking? And, you know, certainly gallbladder, like I said, if, you know, if there is one, which in your scenario, there's not, we always want to look at both the structures that are there and the structures that could radiate there. So the structures that are there are going to be the gallbladder, the liver, the flexure of the colon. Always want to consider, could it just be like an intercostal, like a rib pain, which is actually really your intercostal muscle between the rib pain, which is pretty common.
Is a rib out?
Or is that what I was going to say, yeah. Or is there an actual rib out of place? So any of those are possible. Certainly that's where touching, the palpation, can really be helpful, because that can elicit a little bit more. In severe situations, we should always remember that appendicitis radiates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most situations, we're hopefully not going to be catching a lot of appendicitis. Hopefully that's going to be more of the Western acute care. But appendicitis is always going to have pain. The pain tends to lead to anorexia. That anorexia, or anorexia meaning they can't eat, there's not going to be a lot of appetite. And then that anorexia tends to lead to a temperature issue. They get really hot. Then the next thing we typically see is a white blood cell change, like an elevation in our white blood cells. So that's kind of like the transition, and eventually we can get to, or that's the progression, and then eventually we can get to rupture. So probably if there's not, you know, some of those other symptoms, probably not that, but
and
definitely something we
classic sign is rebound tenderness, which, you know, don't recommend doing if you suspect it's close to rupture, but by pushing in on the right side and there's no pain, but letting go and there's a bunch of pain on the letting out,
mm-hmm.
is a classic sign of appendicitis.
Okay.
So that's one to just know about. And
so it's definitely working through the layers. It's looking at what else caused the inflammation. Are there going to be liver markers elevated? Could there be something like Epstein-Barr, a viral infection could cause, say, both hepatic and splenomegaly? So we're going to see those organs enlarged. So we want to kind of go through and say the step-by-step process, I would say, is like trying to determine what structure it is, doing that by lab test, by palpation if we can. And then once you know the structure, then saying, okay, well, what are all the different root causes that could be really affecting that structure?
Is there irritable bowel disease, and might there be an ulcer there? Is there SIBO, and is the concentration of bacteria highest there so that that area feels the bloating more than other areas? Is there a muscular issue?
Yeah.
All those, you know, it's a little bit of a process to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she brought her to the emergency room a couple times, so I think she's going to get an ultrasound next.
Yeah. Yeah, ultrasounds are always good.
Type of obstruction in our bile ducts.
Great.
Yeah.
That's the first place we
mm-hmm.
go to.
Yeah.
Good. And then with gallbladder removal, that's a time when supplementing with straight up ox bile can be incredibly important, especially when people are eating fattier meals, but maybe even with every meal, because the liver will still make bile but it'll kind of just be continually dumping a little bit of bile, and you won't get that big squeeze from the gallbladder to really dump all that stored bile at one time with a meal to emulsify the fat. So definitely that's something to really strongly consider with a gallbladder being removed. If the gallbladder hasn't been removed and there are issues, then when we talk about treatment, we'll talk more about it, but you might be able to look at cholagogues and precursors like taurine and glycine to bile acids to help stimulate the internal production.
And then, so leaky gut. So leaky gut's going to be a decline in the tight junctions, right? So we're seeing that zonulin and that occludin that were holding those cell walls closely together. A phosphate group is added, and all of a sudden, they are more permeable to different sort of, you know, foods or toxins or whatever may be there. So we see that bacteria, gluten, LPS, all of these different things have the ability to increase zonulin and cause leaky gut. But one thing that we wanted to bring your attention to that's not talked a lot about is we talk a lot about endotoxins, which LPS is an endotoxin, but exotoxins are basically secreted from gram-positive bacteria. The difference between an endotoxin and an exotoxin is endotoxins are actually part of the cell wall of the bacteria. They're found in the gram-negatives. Exotoxins are actually released, they're secreted. They exit the bacteria. Those are found in gram-positive. And the exotoxins can still cause a lot of inflammation and a lot of problems to our intestinal system, can affect leaky gut, but they're not given as much time and as much attention in, I think, the research. One example is toxic shock syndrome. So we know this from women from leaving tampons in for too long. That can secrete a gram-positive exotoxin, or it's a gram-positive bacteria that will secrete the exotoxin. So really want to consider that it's not just the gram-negatives, that all bacteria have the ability to basically cause a leaky gut scenario.
And then, of course, dysbiosis can contribute to leaky gut scenario, CRH, so cortisol dysregulation, mast cells, infections of all kinds can cause increased permeability. So,
I think I've asked this before, just for clarification, leaky gut can happen in the small intestine and large intestine?
Mostly.
So the question is whether the leaky gut can happen in the small and large intestine. We're definitely mostly thinking of that gut barrier as the small intestine gut barrier.
Okay.
There can be leaky stomach, that's possible. There can be some leaking in the large intestine as well. So we're not precluding those, but when we say leaky gut, specifically we're speaking about the small intestine.
But dysbiosis from the colon can cause it.
Yeah.
In a situation where, say, you get dysbiosis from the colon leading to something like a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, that could definitely cause it. And there are common lab tests that are used to look at leakiness of the stomach and leakiness of the small intestine. I haven't really seen anything that seems common from a lab testing perspective that looks at the gut. But we can certainly
the colon.
We can certainly analyze both the small intestine and the stomach for a leaky gut scenario.
So food allergies, these are the IgE, like the salmon allergy I was telling you about that I have. So these are the instantly noticed ones that can be severe in some cases. So, like, I have two different types. I have a salmon allergy, which is an IgE type that's more skin, rash, heat, swelling. And then I have, to cashews, I have an anaphylactic type reaction, which is throat closing and mouth tingling. There's also some swelling that happens there. And then a big stomach pain for a long time after that. The anaphylaxis can be life-threatening, so some people with anaphylactic reactions have to carry EpiPens. I know soon enough that I don't ever eat enough. I know first bite, immediately there's tingling. So even if I didn't know something had cashew in it, if I had one little bite of it, I'd immediately know, and I'd stop eating it, and I'd be fine. But if someone doesn't have that level of sensitivity to it, and they may unintentionally eat a substantial amount of a substance, it can be life-threatening. So in those cases, an EpiPen, epinephrine will stop that response. So that's something to really sort of be aware of. But IgEs are, most people are aware of them. There are some cases where people aren't, but most people know, oh, I'm allergic to cats, I'm allergic to nuts, I'm allergic to peanuts. You know, most people know that, especially if it's a severe IgE reaction. They're going to know because they get immediate feedback. So that's a histamine release.
Someone could develop those later in life, correct? Or do you feel like they're mostly uncovered earlier?
Both. You can, okay. Yeah, you can develop or undevelop allergies.
Yeah,
even IgEs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which lab do you guys use for IgE testing?
We don't honestly do tons of IgE.
We do the basics through Vibrant America, we do a basic food panel and a respiratory panel.
And that's only maybe 15 or so of each.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't do tons of like a full IgE panel for people, mainly because by the time most people get to us, most people know IgE. It's like, you know, like Miles is saying, like most people have some sort of reaction because it's pretty immediate and they know that food's a problem.
Yeah.
And
so, another thing that I was going to make you guys aware of here was just this whole mechanism of action of what's really happening is that the IgEs can lead to leaky gut. So basically, because anything that is going to release too much histamine more than we can break down in our gastrointestinal tract can increase intestinal permeability. It can affect those tight junctions. So we always want to think if we're having a lot of histamine symptoms, that could actually be part of whatever's driving that histamine could be part of whatever is driving the intestinal permeability.
And if total IgE level, which is a measure that we will get on some of the blood tests, is high, then we have to think, well, why is it high or elevated? Is it something seasonal in the environment that we can't control very easily? I mean, we could get a good air purification system for inside, but, or is it something that, you know, someone has a cat and they're reacting to their cat, their IgEs are high, they have histamine flowing through their body at all times, we might, you know, that might be an obstacle to treatment. We might need to talk to them about, you know, as horrible as it sounds, finding a way to either get rid of the cat or have, you know, extreme, get a hypoallergenic cat or shave it, or, you know, something, some way to really good air purification, some way to mitigate that reaction because that could be contributing to symptoms. So if they have a reaction like that and they have a high total IgE level, that could be a real obstacle to treatment and a contributor to symptoms. And unfortunately, with food allergies, unlike food sensitivities, they don't change as easily. They can change, but they don't change as easily. You know, I've done everything in the world to try to get rid of my salmon allergy and cashew allergy and just, you know, cat allergy too, and just couldn't do it.
But I had a cat allergy earlier in life, and then don't have any IgEs that come up from cats now.
Same.
So they definitely can change.
Especially in the formative years of the immune system. But potentially, I mean, I've noticed decreased reaction as the gut's been healed and other things have worked. So, you know, I think it's gone down, but they haven't gone away from me, but they can.
Yeah, it's just less common, tends to be less common for people than the IgGs.
I have an IgE reaction to eggs and dairy, but when I eat those, I don't feel anything.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So, but my concern with having an IgE reaction and not noticing something and still eating them, it's like, what's happening to histamine? And it's like, could that be contributing to an intestinal permeability scenario? So it's a good mechanism to explain to people. It's a good situation you're bringing up because it will come up clinically sometimes. Most people know, but not everybody.
Yeah, had someone come up with a severe reaction to peanuts and she ate peanut butter all the time. And she was having a skin outbreak. And I was saying, well, try stopping eating peanut butter and let's see if your skin gets better. Because she didn't notice the connection, but then her skin did get better as she stopped eating.
Yeah, I've had some clients do tests with traditional allergists, have similar things come up like that. They stopped eating them, they didn't really notice anything. They eat them now again, they don't notice anything. So they've asked me, you know, is that test reliable enough? And I didn't know the answer. You know, like, I've heard from other people, they'll say that you shouldn't really pay that much attention if you're not having something like the skin rashes or the anaphylactic
Yeah, and I don't think that what we're seeing in the research as far as histamine's effect on permeability of like, just because we don't see the reaction, and we know this from, you know, dysbiosis in the gut, just because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. So if it's not obvious, is it contributing to something just like intestinal permeability and just even doing something like causing a little extra inflammation or decreasing a little bit of like nutrient absorption? So if it's there, you know, they might be able to get away with it on occasion, perhaps, probably should not be like a regular food they're doing, because I would just worry about this scenario.
I'll have to take that concept and think about their other symptoms if it comes back to it.
And the total IgE level, you know, is a good indicator for how much that's affecting them. If, you know, if they're regularly eating something they have an IgE reaction to, but their total level is low or normal, maybe they're better able to get away with it than someone who, you know, I had someone come in and they had a few allergens on there and their IgE level was, you know, high, too high. So their total level was, you know, over the top because of what they were, you know, eating and exposing themselves to. So in those cases, that's going to be even more, you know, more damaging. So the total IgE can help you maybe suss out the degree of damage that's going to happen from someone eating something that's triggering an IgE reaction.
So we're going to go through this next part after